The Holy Gospel according to Matthew. Glory to you, O Lord. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel." Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen in its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, Lord Christ. You know the story of the three wise men of the East and how they traveled from far away to offer their gifts at the manger in Bethlehem. But have you heard the story of the other wise man who also saw the star at its rising and set out to follow it, yet did not arrive with the others to offer his gifts to the newborn Jesus? Have you heard of his great wanderings in search of this child, this king, and the way in which he found him at the very last? I will tell it. This is an abridgment and adaptation of a story by Henry Van Dyke that was published in 1885. In the days of Augustus Caesar, when Herod reigned in Jerusalem, there lived in the city of Ecbatana, among the mountains of Persia, a certain man named Artaban. He was a man of great learning and wealth, one who was skilled in healing and in the knowledge of the stars. One day he gathered the magi in the area together. "Hear me, my father and my brothers," he said, "when I tell you of the new light and truth that have come to me through the most ancient of the signs. I and three companions among the magi, Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, have searched the ancient tablets of Chaldea and computed the time when the great king who has been prophesied will appear. We have studied the sky, and in the spring of the year we saw two of the greatest stars draw near together in the sign of the fish, which is in the house of the Hebrews. We also saw a new star there, which shone for one night and then vanished. Now again, the two great planets are meeting. This night is their conjunction. My three brothers are watching at the ancient temple of the seven spheres at Borsippa in Babylonia, and I am watching here. If the star shines again, they will wait 10 days for me at the temple, and then we will set out together for Jerusalem to see and worship the promised one who shall be born king of Israel. I believe the sign will come tonight. I have made ready for the journey. I have sold my house and my possessions and bought these three jewels, a sapphire, a ruby, and a pearl, to carry them as tribute to the king. And I ask you to go with me on the pilgrimage, that we may have joy together in finding the one who is worthy to be served." He showed them three great gems, one blue as a fragment of the night sky, one redder than a ray of sunrise, and one as pure as a peak of a snow mountain at twilight. One of his friends said, "Artaban, this is a vain dream. It comes from much looking upon the stars and the cherishing of lofty thoughts. No king will ever rise from the broken race of Israel, and no end will ever come to the eternal strife of light and darkness. He who looks for it is a chaser of shadows. Farewell. And another said, Ardon, I have no knowledge of these things, and my office as guardian of the royal treasury binds me here. This quest is not for me, but if thou must follow it, fare thee well. And another said, in my house there sleeps a new bride, and I cannot leave her nor take her with me on this strange journey. This quest is not for me, but may thy steps be prospered wherever thou goest. So farewell. But Ardovan's father lingered after the others had gone and said gravely, my son, it may be that the light of truth is in the sign that has appeared in the skies, and then it will surely lead to the prince and the mighty brightness. Or it may be that it is only a shadow of the light, and then he who follows it will have only a long pilgrimage and an empty search. But it is better to follow even the shadow of the best than to remain content with the worst. And those who would see wonderful things must often be ready to travel alone. I am too old for this journey, but my heart shall be a companion of the pilgrimage day and night, and I shall know the end of thy quest. Go in peace. Left to himself, Ardovan put his jewels away and went to take up his vigil to search the night sky. As he watched, Jupiter and Saturn came together like drops of flame, and an azure spark was born out of the darkness beneath them. It pulsed as if the three jewels he possessed had mingled and then transformed into a living heart of light. He bowed his head. It is a sign. The king is coming, and I will go to meet him. All night long, Vasta, the swiftest of Ardovan's horses, had been waiting, saddled and bridled, near a stall, pawing the ground impatiently, and shaking her bit as if she shared the eagerness of her master's purpose, though she knew not its meaning. Long before morning, Ardovan was riding swiftly along the high road, which skirted the base of Mount Orontes, westward. He needed to ride wisely and well if he would keep the appointed hour with the other Magi, for the route was 150 parasangs, more than 500 miles, and 15 parasangs, about 55 miles, was the utmost he could travel in a day. But he knew Vasta's strength and pushed forward without anxiety, making the fixed distance every day, though he must travel late into the night and in the morning long before sunrise. Over many a cold and desolate pass, crawling painfully across the windswept shoulders of the hills, down many a black mountain gorge, through oak groves and abandoned ancient cities, through orchards of peaches and figs, over broad rice fields and parched meadows, the stubble fields and across swirling floods of the Tigris and many channels of the Euphrates, flowing yellow through the cornlands. Ardovan pressed onward until he arrived at nightfall of the 10th day beneath the shattered walls of populous Babylon. His horse was almost spent, and Ardovan would have gladly turned into the city to find rest and refreshment for himself and for her. But he knew that it was 3 hours' journey yet to the Temple of the Seven Spheres, and he must reach the place by midnight if he would find his comrades waiting. So he did not halt, but rode steadily across the stubble fields. A grove of date palms made an island of bloom in the pale yellow sea. As he passed into the shadow, Vasta slackened her pace and began to pick her way more carefully. She felt her steps before her delicately, carrying her head low, and sighing now and then with apprehension. At last she gave a quick breath of anxiety and dismay, and stood stock still, quivering in every muscle, before a dark object in the shadow of the last palm tree. Ardovan dismounted. The dim starlight revealed the form of a man lying across the road. His humble dress and the outline of his haggard face showed that he was probably one of the poor Hebrew exiles who still dwelt in great numbers in the vicinity. His pallid skin, dry and yellow as parchment, bore the mark of the deadly fever which ravaged the marshes in autumn. The chill of death was in his lean hand, And as Artaban released it, the arm fell back upon a motionless breast. He turned away with a thought of pity, but as he turned, a long, faint, ghostly sigh came from the man's lips. Brown, bony fingers closed convulsively on the hem of the Magi's robe. Artaban's heart leaped into his throat, not with fear, but with a dumb resentment at the inopportunity of this blind delay. How could he stay here in the darkness to minister to a dying stranger? What claim had this unknown fragment of human life upon his compassion or service? If he lingered but an hour, he could hardly reach Rosipa at the appointed time. His companions would think he'd given up. They would go on without him. He would lose his quest. But if he went on now, this man would surely die. If he stayed, he might be restored. His spirit throbbed and fluttered with the urgency of the crisis. Should he risk the great reward of his divine faith for the sake of a single deed of human love? Should he turn aside, if only for a moment, from following the star to give a cup of cold water to a poor, perishing people? God of truth and purity, he prayed, direct me in the holy path, the way of wisdom which thou only knowest. Then he turned back to the sick man. Loosening the grasp of his hand, he carried him to a little mound in the palm tree. He unbound the thick folds of the turban and opened the garment above the sunken breast. He brought water from one of the small canals nearby and moistened the sufferer's brow and mouth. He prepared one of those simple but potent remedies which he carried with him, for the Magi were physicians as well as astrologers, and poured it slowly between the colorless lips of the man. Hour after hour, he labored as only a skillful healer of disease can, and at last the man's strength returned. He sat up and looked about him. "Who art thou?" he asked, in the rude dialect of the country. "And why hast thou sought me to bring thee back on life?" "I am Artaban, the Magian of the city of Ecbatana, and I am going to Jerusalem in search of the one who is to be born king of the Jews, a great prince and deliverer for all men. I dare not delay any longer upon my journey, for the caravan that has waited for me may depart without me. But see, here is all that I have left of bread and wine, and here is a potion of human herbs. When thy strength is restored, thou canst find the dwellings of the Hebrews among the houses of Babylon." The man raised his trembling hand and said, "Now may the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob bless and prosper the journey of the merciful, and bring him in peace to his desired kingdom. But stay, I have nothing to give thee in return, only this, that I can tell thee where the Messiah must be sought. For our prophets have said that he should be born not in Jerusalem, but in Bethlehem of Judah. May the Lord bring thee in safety to that place, because thou hast taken pity upon the sick." It was already long past midnight. Artaban rode in haste, and Vasta, restored by the brief rest, ran eagerly through the silent plain and swam the channel of the river. She put forth the remnant of her strength and fled over the ground like a gazelle. As the morning dawned, they arrived at the Temple of the Seven Spheres, but Artaban could discern no trace of his friends. He dismounted and climbed to the highest terrace, looking out toward the west, but there was no sign of the caravan of the wise men, far or near. At the edge of the terrace, he saw a little cairn of broken bricks, and under them a piece of parchment. He caught it up and read, "We have waited past midnight and can delay no longer. We go to find the king. Follow us across the desert." Artaban sat down upon the ground and covered his head in despair. "How can I cross the desert?" he said, "with no food and with a spent horse. I must return to Babylon and sell my sapphire and buy a train of camels and provisions for the journey. I may never overtake my friends. Only God the Merciful knows whether I shall not lose sight of the king." As Artaban continued the journey by camel, he came to stony wastelands and inhospitable mountain ranges. and shifting hills of treacherous sand. By day, the fierce heat pressed its intolerable burden on the quivering air, and no moving creature lived. By night, the jackals prowled and barked in the distance, and the lion made the black ravines echo with his hollow roaring, while a bitter, blighting chill followed the fever of the day. Through heat and cold, Argon moved steadily onward. And at last, he came to the highlands of Judah, and then he arrived at Bethlehem. And it was the third day after the three wise men had come to that place and had found the child and Mary and Joseph and had laid their gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh at his feet. Then the other wise man drew near, weary but full of hope, bearing his ruby and the pearl to offer the king. For now at last, he said, I shall surely find him, though it be alone and later than my brethren. This is the place of which the Hebrew exile told me that the prophets had spoken, and here I shall behold the rising of the great light. But I must inquire about the visit of my brethren, and to what house the star directed them, and to whom they presented their tribute. The streets of the village appeared to be deserted, and Artaban wondered whether the men had all gone up to the hill pastures to bring down their sheep. From the open door of a low stone cottage, he heard the sound of a woman's voice singing softly. He entered and found a young mother hushing her baby to rest. She told him of the strangers from the far east who had appeared in the village 3 days ago, and how they had said that a star had guided them to the place where Joseph of Nazareth was lodging with his wife and a newborn child, and how they had paid reverence to the child and given him many rich gifts. But the travelers disappeared again, she continued, as suddenly as they had come. We were afraid at the strangeness of their visit. We could not understand it. The man of Nazareth took the babe and his mother and fled away that same night secretly, and it was whispered that they were going as far away as Egypt. Ever since, there has been a spell upon the village, something evil hanging over it. They say that the Roman soldiers are coming from Jerusalem to force a new tax from us, and the men have driven the flocks and herds far back among the hills and hidden themselves to escape it. Artaban listened to her gentle speech, and the child in her arms looked up in his face and smiled, stretching out its rosy hands to grasp at the winged circle of gold on his breast. His heart warmed to the touch. It seemed like a greeting of love and trust to one who had journeyed long, fighting with his own doubts and fears, and following a light that was veiled in clouds. Might not this child have been the promised prince, he asked himself, as he touched the soft cheek. Kings have been born in lowlier houses than this, and the favorite of the stars may even now rise from a cottage. But it does not seem good to the God of wisdom to reward my search so soon and so easily. The one whom I seek has gone before me, and now I must follow the king to Egypt. The young mother laid the child in the cradle and rose to care for the guest that fate had brought into her house. She set food before him, the plain fare of peasants, but willingly offered, and therefore full of refreshment for the soul as well as for the body. Artaban accepted it gratefully, and as he ate, the child fell into a happy slumber and murmured sweetly in its dreams, and a great peace for the quiet room. But suddenly there came the noise of wild confusion and uproar in the streets of the village, a shrieking and wailing of women's voices, a clang of broken trumpets and clashing swords, and a desperate cry, the soldiers of Herod, they are killing our children. The young mother's face grew white with terror. She picked up her child, held him tightly, and crouched motionless in the darkened corner of the room, covering the child with the folds of her robe, lest he should wake and cry. But Artaban went quickly and stood in the doorway of the house. His broad shoulders filled the portal from side to side, and the peak of his white cap all but touched the lintel. The soldiers came hurrying down the street with bloody hands and dripping swords. At the sight of the stranger in his imposing dress, they hesitated with surprise. The captain of the band approached the threshold to thrust him aside, but Artaban did not stir. His face was as calm as though he were watching the stars, and in his eyes there burned that steady radiance before which even the half-tamed hunting leopard shrinks, and the fierce bloodhound pauses in his mouth. He held the soldiers silently for an instant, and then said in a low voice, "There's no one in this place but me, and I'm waiting to give this jewel to the prudent captain who will leave me in peace." He showed the ruby, glistening in the hollow of his hand like a great drop of blood. The captain was amazed at the splendor of the gem. The pupils of his eyes expanded with desire, and the hard lines of greed wriggled around his lips. He stretched out his hand and took the ruby. "March on," he cried to the men. "There is no child here. The house is still." The clamor and clang of arms passed down the street as the headlong fury of the chase sweeps by the secret cupboard where the trembling deer is hidden. Artaban re-entered the cottage. He turned his face to the east and prayed, "God of truth, forgive my sin that I have said the thing that is not, to save the life of a child. And yet my gifts are gone. I have spent for man that which was meant for God. Shall I ever be worthy to see the face of the king?" But the voice of the woman, weeping with joy in the shadow behind him, said gently, "Because thou hast saved the life of my little one, may the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace." Artaban sought everywhere for traces of the household that had come down from Bethlehem. He passed by the pyramids, which lifted their sharp points into the intense saffron glow of the sunset sky. Changeless mountains of the perishable glory and the imperishable hope of man. He looked up into the vast countenance of the crouching Sphinx and vainly tried to grasp the meaning of her calm eyes and smiling mouth. He came to an obscure house in Alexandria, taking counsel with a Hebrew rabbi. The venerable man, bending over the rolls of parchment on which the prophecies of Israel were written, read aloud the words which foretold the suffering of the promised Messiah, the despised and rejected of men, the man of sorrows, the one acquainted with grief. "And remember, my son," said he, fixing his deep-set eyes upon the face of Artaban, "the king whom you are seeking is not to be found in a palace among the rich and powerful. If the light of the world and the glory of Israel had been appointed to come with the greatness of earthly splendor, it must have appeared long ago. For no son of Abraham will ever again rival the power which Joseph had in the princes of Egypt, or the magnificence of Solomon throned between the lions in Jerusalem. But the light for which the world is waiting is a new light, the glory that shall rise out of patient and triumphant suffering. And the kingdom which is to be established forever is a new kingdom, the royalty of perfect and unconquerable love. I do not know how this shall come to pass, nor how the turbulent kings and peoples of earth shall be brought to acknowledge the Messiah and pay homage to him. But this I know, those who seek him will do well to look among the poor and the lowly, the sorrowful and the oppressed." Artaban traveled from place to place, searching among the people of the dispersion, with whom the little family from Bethlehem might perhaps have found a refuge. He passed through countless countries where famine lay heavy upon the land and the poor were crying for bread. He made his dwelling in plague-stricken cities where the sick were languishing in the bitter companionship of helpless misery. He visited the oppressed and the afflicted in the gloom of subterranean prisons, in the crowded wretchedness of slave markets, in the weary toil of galley ships. In all this populous and intricate world of anguish, though he found none to worship, he found many to help. He fed the hungry, and clothed the naked, and healed the sick, and comforted the captive, and his years went by quickly. It seemed almost as if he had forgotten his quest, but at times he took from its secret resting place the pearl, the last of his jewels. As he looked at it, a mellower luster, a soft and iridescent light, full of shifting gleams of azure and rose, tumbled upon its surface. It seemed to have absorbed some reflection of the colors of the lost sapphire and ruby. 33 years of Artaban's life had passed away, and he was still a pilgrim and a seeker after light. His hair, once dark, was white as snow. His eyes, at once flashed like flames of fire, were dull as embers smoldering among the ashes. Worn and weary and ready to die, but still looking for the king, he had come for the last time to Jerusalem. He had often visited the holy city before and had searched through all of its lanes and crowded hovels and black prisons without finding any trace of the family of Nazarenes who had been fleeing from Bethlehem long ago. But now it seemed as if he must make one more effort, and something whispered in his heart that, at last, he might succeed. It was the season of Passover. The city was strong with strangers. The children of Israel, scattered in far lands all over the world, had returned to the temple for the great feast, and there had been a confusion of tongues in the narrow streets for many days. But on this day, there was a singular agitation visible in the multitude. The sky was veiled with a portentous gloom, and currents of excitement seemed to flash through the crowd, like the thrill which shakes the forest in the eye of a storm. A secret tide was swirling them all one way. The clatter of sandals and the soft, thick sound of thousands of bare feet shuffling over the stones flowed unceasingly along the street that led to the Damascus Gate. Artaban joined company with a group of people from his own country, Parthian Jews who had come to keep the Passover, and inquired of them the cause of the tumult and where they were going. "We are going," they answered, "to the place called Golgotha, outside the city walls, where there is to be an execution. Have you not heard what has happened? Two famous robbers are to be crucified, and with them another, called Jesus of Nazareth, a man who has done many wonderful works among the people, so that they love him greatly. But the priests and the elders have said that he must die, because he gave himself out to be the Son of God. And Pilate has sent him to the cross, because he said that he was the king of the Jews." How strangely these familiar words fell upon the tired heart of Artaban. They had led him for a lifetime over land and sea, and now they came to him darkly and mysteriously like a message of despair. The king had arisen, but he had been denied and cast out. He was about to perish. Perhaps he was already dying. Could it be that the same who had been born in Bethlehem 33 years ago, at his birth the star had appeared in heaven, and of his coming the prophets had spoken? Could it be he? Artaban's heart beat unsteadily with that troubled, doubtful apprehension which is the excitement of old age. But he said within himself, "The ways of God are stranger than the thoughts of men, and it may be that I shall find the king at last in the hands of his enemies, and shall come to bring, and shall come in time to offer my pearl for his ransom before he dies." So the old man followed the multitude with slow and painful steps toward the Damascus gate of the city. Just beyond the entrance of the guardhouse, a troop of Macedonian soldiers came down the street, dragging a young girl with torn dress and disheveled hair. As Magian paused to look at her with compassion, she broke suddenly from the hands of her tormentors and threw herself at his feet, clasping him around the knees. She had seen his white cap and the wind circle on his breast that declared him to be magi. "Have pity on me," she cried, "and save me for the sake of the god of purity. I also am a daughter of the true religion which is taught by the magi. My father was a merchant of Parthia, but he is dead, and I am seized for his debts to be sold as a slave. Save me from worse than death." Artaban trembled. It was the old conflict in his soul which had come to him in the palm grove in Babylon and in the cottage at Bethlehem, the conflict between the expectation of faith and the impulse of love. Twice the gift which he had consecrated to the worship of religion had been drawn from his hand to the service of humanity. This was the third trap, the ultimate probation, the final and irrevocable choice. Was it his great opportunity or his last temptation? He could not tell. One thing only was clear in the darkness of his mind. It was inevitable, and does not the inevitable come from God. One thing only was sure to his divided heart, to rescue this helpless girl would be a true deed of love. And is not love the light of the soul? He took the pearl from his bosom. Never had it seemed so luminous, so radiant, so full of tender, living luster. He laid it in the hand of the slave. This is thy ransom, daughter. It is the last of my treasures which I kept for the king. While he spoke, the darkness of the sky thickened, and shuddering tremors ran through the earth, heaving convulsively, like the breast of one who struggles with mighty grief. The walls of the houses rocked to and fro. Stones were loosened and crashed in the street. Dust clouds filled the air. The soldiers fled in terror. But Artaban and the girl whom he had ransomed crouched helpless beneath the wall of the dripping ring. What had he to fear? What had he to live for? He had given away the last remnant of his tribute for the king. He had parted with the last hope of finding him. The quest was over, and it had failed. But even in that thought, there was peace. It was not resignation. It was not submission. It was something more profound and searching. He knew that all was well because he'd done the best that he could from day to day. He had been true to the light that had been given to him. He had looked for more, and he had not found it. If a failure was all that came out of his life, doubtless that was the best that was possible. He had not seen the revelation of life everlasting, but he knew that even if he could live his earthly life over again, it could not be otherwise than it had been. One more lingering pulsation of the earthquake quivered through the ground. A heavy tile shaken from the roof fell and struck the old man on the head. He lay breathless and pale, with his gray head resting on the young girl's shoulders and the blood trickling from his wound. She bent over him, fearing that he was dead. There came a voice through the twilight, very small and still, like music sounding from a distance, in which the notes are clear and the words are lost. The girl turned to see if someone had spoken from the window above, but she saw no one. Then the old man's lips began to move, as if in answer. And she heard him say in the Parthian tongue, "Not so, my lord. For when saw I thee hungered and fed thee, and thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw I thee a stranger and took thee in, and naked and clothed thee? When saw I thee in prison and came unto thee? 3 and 30 years have I looked for thee, but I have never seen my face, nor ministered to thee, my king." He ceased, and the sweet voice came again. And again the girl heard it, very faintly and far away. But now it sounded as though she understood the words. "Verily I say unto thee, inasmuch as thou hast done it to one of the least of these my brethren, thou hast done it unto me." A calm radiance of wonder and joy tightened the pale face of Artaban at the first ray of dawn on the singing mountain peak. One long last breath of relief exhaled gently from his lips. His journey was ended. His treasures were accepted. The other wise men had found his king. And that is the story of